Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Stan Greer and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. I'm putting my watch here so I can watch that. I brought something with me. I'm going to begin by telling you that there's only one place I would less rather be this morning. And that would be waking up that morning, September 6, 1976. When I woke up, came out of a blackout, which was my last drink, shortly after my last drink. I'm going to read to you to begin with, because I start each day with two meditation books that were given to me the first day I was in the program, 24 hours a day and day by day. And both of these books have been with me for the course of my sobriety. And I try to live my life directed by the thought for the day or the prayer for the day that I get. So I'm going to read you from the day by day today. It's called Sharing Opinions. At first, really hearing fellow addicts is an exciting experience. We may charge off explaining our insights at meetings and social gatherings. We truly need to share in this manner, but it should not affect us too much when other people don't accept our pearls of wisdom. What may be a gem for us could be a mere pebble for another. So when others shoot us down for something we've said, we needn't take it too personally. What is right for one may not be right for another. However, we all have the right to express our opinions. Do I share my views freely with others? Lord, may my sharing not turn into imposing, and may I not take opinions as personal insults or rejections. Today, I will share my deepest insights with blank, with all of you who have gathered here this morning, brought here, I'm sure, by the lure of two tickets to the Roundup in Dallas. Whatever. Thank you for being here. My story begins, I don't even know how to start. I don't do this very often, and so I'm just going to ad lib it. I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas. I was born in 1947. I was born into a family, a loving family. I had three older brothers. They were 7, 11, and 13 years older than me. So I was a late baby. The result of that was by the time I was in the fourth grade, I was an only child because all my brothers had left. And so I got to have the attention and focus of my parents through my schooling years. Alcohol was not something that really cropped up into my life during those years. There was something different about me, and I didn't know what it was. And I say that in all sincerity. I had no idea what was with me, that I seemed so apart from all the people that I went to school with, that I just never seemed to fit in right, and I had this desperate desire to fit, and I didn't know how to do it. I was going through I was doing all the things that my peers were doing. I was trying to participate at school. I was not blessed with the greatest intellect, so I had A's did not come easy for me. I went through high school and I did not graduate with honors because I made two D's in freshman algebra and in freshman chemistry. Other than that, I did very well. I didn't have any C's and only a few B's and the rest A's. But I had to work in school, and I also worked. My father had started when I was even younger. I had started going with my mom and dad onto a pie shop and cafe in Fort Worth, and I would go with them to work in the morning before I went to school. And helped get the shop opened, make coffee, do things like that. And I ended up working in some form or another, part-time, all the way through school. And I just never seemed to have time to get into a lot of trouble. But I was also very apart from all the people that I was surrounded by in school. It's like I was living two lives. I had a fantasy life in my head where I was it, if anybody knows what that is. And then I had this reality side. And at that time, you know, I was very unsure. Sometimes I enjoyed it, sometimes I didn't. I seemed to always want more, and I could never get enough. And so I graduated from high school, and I went to college. And the first semester that I went to school, I was at Arlington State College in Arlington, Texas, which is now the University of Texas at Arlington. And I made the dean's list. And that was a miracle, because at the same time, all of these feelings that I had started to manifest themselves when I got into college. I started to meet other people that were sort of like me. And sort of like me was being gay. And I really didn't know that there were other people in the world that felt like that. So I went away. I went to school and I worked full time. And some friends of mine wanted me to, my best friend was a gay, and I didn't really know it. I found out, and it was, you know, that was cool. And he and several other friends decided to take me to Dallas for New Year's Eve, which would be in 1965, 1966. And I had occasionally had a drink. I didn't drink during high school, and when I got out, it was something that was fun, because I felt like I was older at last. You know, I was grown up now. I could really do this. And so we went on New Year's Eve and to this party in Dallas, and there were all these people drinking. The bar was, you know, going full tilt, and I met someone. Actually, it was kind of a setup. Another friend of mine had brought a friend, and I met this fellow named Phil. And we hit it off together. And for the next 9 months, we became very close. And I fell in love. And he was still in high school. I was a year older than he was. And that summer, really interesting. That summer, I saw something. Something happened to me. We both worked, and I got off from work one Saturday night, and I went to meet up with him. Even though he had his own car, I met up with him at his job, which got off a little later than mine, and we were going to go to Dallas and do our thing and party. And we left the shopping center, and we were driving down the street, and he was following me, and I was going on this street in Fort Worth called Seminary Drive. It has a big S curve in it, and I was just started off from this light, and all of a sudden there was a truck in front of me, and I hit it square head on. And it was a fella who was drunk. And I went through the windshield, the front one, and I went through the back one. Because guess who hit me from the back? Bill. And I ended up in the hospital and an insurance lawsuit that went on for months and months and months. And I never wanted to be like that. I was angry at that man because he scarred up my face, which is kind of gone now. But that kind of thing couldn't happen to me. It wasn't long after that that Phil went away to school, and he said those words, I want to just be friends. And that was the ignition. I was so hurt inside. I couldn't find anything to fix that. And alcohol sort of worked. It sort of filled up that hole. And that was in 1966, and I went on to school for another 2 semesters, actually. I went to TCU that fall, and I didn't do very well. I was pre-med. And then I decided I needed to get out of town. I needed to get away. So I went to Stephen F. Austin in Nacogdoches for a semester. That didn't work either. That didn't work at all. But as things happen, I met someone when I came to Houston for a weekend, and I met this fellow, Jimmy Rothbauer. Jimmy's funny because I'll stop right now and tell you that for those of you who are from Houston, Jimmy was the first person I ever lived with. Because Philip and I had never, we both lived at home. I moved to Houston that summer after school was out to live with Jimmy. And years later, I run into Sonny. And this is a pattern in my life, my drinking life. I met Jimmy and I moved to Houston. And 2 weeks after I was here, his ex came back. And all of a sudden, I was in the extra bedroom, and they were together, and I was by myself again. And after that one, Jimmy married Sonny. Sonny and I have something in common. We have an ex in common. I was working at that point. As I said, I was pre-med in school. Well, I decided to quit school. I was a licensed medical technologist at that point. I'd been grandfathered in because of the loving care of a lot of people in Fort Worth, a lot of doctors who had helped me along and encouraged me. And so I was out there working. I worked 3 jobs that year. I lived in Houston for a year. I moved here in 1967. I moved away in 1968. I lived here. I worked at Kelsey Seabold full-time during the day. I went to work at Bentaub in the emergency room when I got off from that job. And on weekends, I worked at a series of bars from downtown at the Red Room and then later at the Plantation Club. Drinking wasn't a big issue. I didn't have a lot of time. I was working most of the time. Had a lot of, short relationships. Went to finish my first year, got my first 2-week paid vacation, and decided to go visit some friends from Fort Worth who had moved to Los Angeles. Well, did it again. Met somebody in L.A. The last day I was there. Came home 2 weeks later. I quit my job and I moved to Los Angeles. 2 weeks later, I was on my own. I did have a job. I was intelligent enough to arrange a job before I did this. So that was in the 60s in Los Angeles. The late 60s, 68, 69, and into 1970. And it was party time. I only had to have one job there because they paid so well. And I lived with my friends, my two dearest friends from Fort Worth, and it was okay. It was okay. Little drugs here and there came into play. Tried LSD once, didn't like it. But I drank. But it was not really an issue at that point. Then I just didn't like what I was doing. I was in this field, in this medical field, and you know, I'd wanted to be a doctor, but I wasn't going to go back to school. I wasn't going to do that, so I just wanted a clean break, and I just wanted to do something entirely different. So I moved back to Houston, and I moved in with my old roommate, and I went to work at Sackwitz in the men's department. And I began to drink a little more. Developed a taste for scotch. And after a few months of doing that job, I decided to... I had met a number of people, and I was fascinated with jewelry. And Tiffany and Company was fixing to move from the store they had here in Houston in the downtown area in an office building out to the Galleria, because the Galleria was fixing to open. And I applied for a job as a stock boy, and I got it. And so I moved across the street from Sackwitz into the Galleria, and I started to work at Tiffany's. And it was, I was in heaven. It was just wonderful. Here I was in this big fancy store, this crazy little kid from Fort Worth, and it didn't matter to me that I was packing stuff and unwrapping stuff, and I wanted to be a part of that. So I worked hard, and a year after I started to work there. Well, a few months after I started to work, my boss noticed that I had a way with the stock and the inventory, and they were instituting an inventory control system, which they had not ever had before. And I sort of set that up and did well. And soon I was a year after I started there in 1970, I became the assistant store manager, and that was a title. Oh. And I had a business card, and it said assistant manager, Tiffany and Company. And oh, it was really hot stuff then. And of course, I made a little more money. A little more money, a little more drinking. So for the next 3 years, I made a little more money each year, and I drank a little more each year. And I was still trying to fill this hole up, and, you know, it just wasn't working. And I was still with my same roommate, the one I'd lived with after I'd gotten thrown out back in the 60s. And Lyman had a brother, and this brother came. He was going off to... He'd been off in Vietnam. He was home on leave, and he was going back. He was in the Navy. And he came to visit for a week. Guess what? He was getting out of the service in 6 months. And he was going to live in San Francisco. So 2 weeks before he got back to San Francisco, I quit my job that I love so much and moved to San Francisco and set up house. And he got home, and guess what? No, it wasn't 2 weeks. It was only one. So here I am, a Navy widow, living in this godforsaken place, and San Francisco was across the bay. I was in Alameda looking at the city, and so I have to go across San Francisco and find an apartment and move in, and oh dear, I went to work at iMagnon, and that was an experience. I worked with a man who was an alcoholic. He was a real alcoholic. He often didn't show up for work. He would be gone for 3 or 4 days in a row on a binge, and he would come back looking bad. And he had this very peculiar habit, which I found was very, very good habit. He put sanitary napkins under his arms inside his jacket so the perspiration wouldn't go through his jackets at work. Well, I was starting to have that problem. I was a sweater. And of course, when you consumed as much scotch as I did at night, you had a tendency to expel it the next day at work. And so this was very convenient. It kept your sleeves from rotting out on the inside. You could stuff those in there and, you know, you could make it. So I learned something from this man. Well, Tiffany was still in the back of my mind, and my old boss called one day at the urging of a couple of other friends. I had been forewarned, and asked me if I wanted to come back. And so I said, sure, I'll come back. So I came back 9 months after I moved off to San Francisco. I moved back to Houston again. That's in 1973 in November. It was just about at Thanksgiving. I moved back to Houston. Now, I got here and, you know, I had some bad experiences in San Francisco. I was searching for something. I'd become an Episcopalian in high school. I was raised in the Baptist church, and I'd become an Episcopal because I sang in the choir. And during Lent in 1973, I crawled up Nob Hill to Grace Cathedral every morning of Lent. And I would go in at 7 o'clock service, and I would sit there. And I was talking to God. And I wasn't hearing anything. I was calling, and the line was busy. But I did it, and I would, you know, sometimes in a haze, and I would stumble back down the hills. I had a terrible blackout experience in San Francisco. And I don't know how I survived that, but I did. I came back to Houston and got this job back that I love so much. And proceeded to go along for the next couple of years, 73 to 75, drinking a lot. 1974, something incredible happened. I decided with a good friend of mine who still works with me today that I was through with boyfriends. I wasn't interested. I was just going, we were both going to just be single the rest of our lives and be happy. And I made that decision, oh, I don't remember. It was sometime in the summer. It was on a trip down to Galveston for the after a Saturday at work. And, I don't know. I think it was a Monday, but it could have been a Friday or a Thursday. I don't remember what day it was. We decided after work one afternoon to go to Dirty Sally's. And went to Dirty Sally's, and I met this guy. And he was nice. His name was Al. Met old Al. And he came home with me, and we watched a football game, among other things. And very unusual. And a week later, I called him to see if he wanted to go out again. And I happened to call him on his birthday. And there were a bunch of people. He was having a birthday party, and he didn't have time to talk to me, and said he'd get back to me later, and kind of blew me off. And So back at Dirty Sally's, I run into him again. Well, that was nice. I was a little mad that I'd been blown off, but it's all right. And that began a courtship, if you will, that lasted for just short of a year, about 10 months. And in 1974, in 1975, we moved in together, got an apartment together. And by now, my drinking had reached the point where, I'll tell you one little story. I was in New York. I was now the associate manager of this store and had 48 employees, I think. And I was in New York for my annual visit, which was always capped off with the last day with a meeting with the chairman of the board to discuss the state of the store in Houston. And this particular night, I went to dinner with a friend, and I embarrassed myself monumentally with him throughout the whole evening. And I'm not going to go into great details, but let us say that I woke up the next morning with 3 broken ribs. I'd had a lamp slammed into the side of my face. I was monumentally uncomfortable, and I didn't know why. I didn't know why that happened, but I couldn't possibly go see Walter Hoving that morning. So I went in and I told everybody I slipped in the shower and hit the corner of the bathtub, and they all felt sorry for me. Of course, I realized today that they all knew what had happened, but I didn't think so. I thought I covered it up very well, and I went to the airport early, and it's still in a haze, and I got on the plane to Houston, I thought. It wasn't. It went to Atlanta, and it was a rough flight, and I've got 3 broken ribs. And so I had to lay over there and get another plane to Houston, and I got back, and Mr. Al picked me up at the airport, and that was in the summer, I believe, of 1975. And soon after that, he went to my doctor. He had talked to my doctor and suggested that I might have a problem with my drinking. And my doctor, being the wonderful man that he was, told him that no, he just didn't understand the stress that I was under at work, and that, you know, this was normal for the course of things. And so nothing happened, but I continued to kind of go downhill. We were trying to have a relationship, and I was getting drunk virtually every night, going to bed with, you know, bottle, with an iced tea glass of scotch or an iced tea glass of brandy or, you know, whatever, and thinking, you know, what a gracious life we lived. Making great plans for great dinners and going places and not getting there because my scotch was too important before I got started out, so I had to get loaded before I could go, and then by the time I was ready to go, there wasn't any point in going because our dinner was burned, or, you know, it was over, the show was over, we were late, or what, we didn't do anything. And then in the summer of 1976, my last drunk, the last weekend, was Sweet Al decided he was going to go to Brownsville and visit his parents. And all of my friends were going to California and for the weekend, a fly-in weekend in Los Angeles, for any of you know what that is. And I decided I was going to go do that. And I made the decision very rash, you know, just on the spur of the moment. And so off I flew to Los Angeles and back to L.A. And that was the weekend of my last drunk. I started drinking on that plane on a Friday afternoon. And I think I had my last drink at Dirty Sally's on Labor Day morning, probably about 6 or 6:30. I don't remember. I don't know how I got from the airport. I don't know how I found my car in the parking lot at the airport. That's a miracle. I don't know how I got into the city. I don't know how I got home and not alone. But I had been entrusted with something rather expensive for my store. And when I woke up in that haze, it was a watch, and it was a diamond watch, quite expensive diamond watch. It was gone. And my first reaction was to jump in the car and start trying to find who had taken my watch, and I was driving all over the Montrose. I didn't know what they looked like. I didn't know who they were. And I went into Sally's, and I'm shaking a bartender who wasn't even working when I was there that morning, demanding that he tell me who had my watch. And I was driving home, and for the first time in my life, I realized that this chain of events would not have occurred if I'd not been drunk, if I'd not been blacked out. And that was a moment. Al came home a few hours later to find me a perfect mess. Took me to Alfred's for matzo ball soup. And I didn't have a drink. The next night, The office manager at the store, and a lovely woman who lives out in California now, as a matter of fact, she and her husband had me over for dinner, had Al and I over for dinner. And when we arrived, it was a Tuesday night, she and her husband drank wine, but she had gone and bought a bottle of Chivas Regal for me. And I had to say, Margene, I can't drink anymore. I just can't do that. And she and her husband were so sweet. They encouraged me. They had a friend who was an alcoholic, and they knew that it was possible for someone not to drink. And so they encouraged me, and at that point, as we were leaving dinner that night, we called my doctor on the phone, and he lived very close by, just short half a mile maybe, and he said, come on over. And it was probably 10 o'clock or so at night, and Al and I went over to his house, and I told him, I think I have a problem with my drinking. And he whipped out his prescription pad and he started writing, and I thought, oh, he's there, can fix it. You know, it's great. Well, he gave me this phone number on this prescription pad, and it was Intergroup. And he said, Stan, when you get up in the morning before 10 o'clock, I want you to call this number. And if you can't do it, you call me and I'll do it for you. At 9:59, I'm at my desk at Tiffany's. Now, you understand, I have this horror thing that's happened. You know, I've lost this very valuable piece, and I'm hysterical that I'm going to lose my job, and I'm willing to do anything now to save my job, anything. And I made that call and spoke to this young woman in her group who was charming. Told me somebody would call me back. And this nice man named Don B called me back about 11 o'clock. And he said, "You want to go to lunch?" And I said, "Well, sure, sure." He says, "I'll pick you up at 11:45. So off I go to lunch. And it's a nice looking man. He's dressed up. And he starts telling me about his drinking. He grew up in the same place I did, went to the same high school that I went to, was a few years ahead of me, but actually went to school with an ex-sister-in-law of mine. And in the process, he told me a lot of his story. And we went into the cathedral group downtown. I thought I was going to lunch. It's a funny-looking restaurant. I was in a navy blue suit, and I found out I was going to an AA meeting. And I thought, "Oh, dear God, I'm going to be so overdressed." And we went into this place, and there were a lot of people there. Back in those days, that meeting was a big meeting. The noon meeting at the cathedral group was probably one of the bigger meetings in the city. And there were, you know, over 100 people there, I'm sure. And I sat on the back row, and I sat next to Don, and this other man sat next to me, whose name was Jerry D. And I shook, and I sweated, and I felt terrible. I didn't want to be there. All those people, but they look so different. They all look so good. And they weren't shaking. And at the end of the meeting, they offered chips. And these two guys punched me when it was time for a desire chip. And they said, "That's you. Go get it." And I didn't know what I was doing. I got up and I walked to the front of the room, and all these people were clapping, and they put this chip in my hand, and I closed my hand on it, and I walked back to my seat, and something happened. Something happened. It was incredible. The hole was sort of gone. I felt like maybe I was in the right place at the right time for the first time in my life. Don was wonderful. I don't know where Don is today. I think he lives in Colorado, but Don was wonderful. He took me back, and I blabbered all the way back, told him my story, all the way back to work. And I got home that night, and he was sitting in the driveway of my house with these two books, and a big book. And he told me that he'd be back at 7:30 to pick me up to take me to another meeting. And so, 7:30, he picked me up, and we went downtown to the Texas house at the time. And Don just happened to be telling his story. So I heard his whole story that night. And next morning, he called me before I left for work and came by and took me to that noon meeting again and proceeded to do that for the next 2 weeks. I went through DTs at work. I came off of all that alcohol. And on Saturday night, that first Saturday night, he took me to the 24-hour club to the speaker meeting, which I think was at 10:30 at the time, or 11, somewhere along there. It was late. And I heard someone speak, a little black woman, a little short, tiny, shriveled up thing. And she introduced herself, and she said, "You know, my name is such and such, and I don't remember it now, but," she said, "I'm a commode-hugging drunk." And I knew exactly what she was talking about. I knew exactly what she meant. Because that's what I did. I got sick when I drank. I threw up a lot. Well, I heard a lot of things in those first few weeks that I was around this program, going to a lot of meetings, at least two a day. And I heard that, you know, that I began to see that I might be able to save my job. Might. It was kind of unclear at that point. But I found out that it was possible to not drink one day at a time. It was a new concept for me. Before I knew it, I had 2 weeks. And I was hearing people in meetings talk about sponsors. And this presented the first great dilemma for me in sobriety. I had this wonderful man, Don B., who was straight, who had shepherded me through, 12-stepped me through this meeting. And I had this other man, Jerry D., who was gay, who had this remarkable twinkle in his eye, as did most of the people that I saw in this program, this twinkle, I don't know. They laughed. I hadn't done that in a long time. I hadn't laughed. I hadn't felt good in a long time. And I started gradually to feel a little better. And I had to make this decision about, you know, about this sponsor thing. And so I was really torn, and finally I decided that, you know, I was gay. I was okay with that, but I was not okay with talking about that to a straight man. So I asked Jerry to be my sponsor. And he was wonderful. He was a wonderful man. He sponsored me for a little over 16 years. And he knew he had a real mess on his hands. I don't know what he wanted. I was talking about things. I got him as a sponsor, and I was immediately talking about doing the fourth step, but I was already doing the ninth step. But I wanted to do the fourth step, and this is when he told me I was going to do one step a year. And a lot of you have heard me talk, know that that's the way I was brought into this program, was you work one step a year. And I didn't know what that meant. I thought I was retarded. I didn't know, but I said, okay, I'm willing to do it. I'm willing to do that. You see, what happened was, sometime in those first few months, the alcohol cleared out of my system, and I found out I could live without drinking. Now, when I got here, I didn't think that was possible. I'd never been able to stop for not even for a day. I would swear it off at, you know, in the morning. I wasn't going to have another hangover like that. I was not going to drink that night. And then 5:36, well, just one. And that just didn't work. Jerry took care of me. A lot of people took care of me in this program early on. I was able to, I'd been left an inheritance that year, small, but it was really strange. There was just enough money in the savings account to pay for that bloody watch. And so instead of getting fired, I bought a watch that I didn't have, that somebody else had, who's out there wearing it today, which is wonderful. It's the biggest gift I ever gave anybody in my life. What can I tell you? I stayed sober that first year. My sobriety, I drank for 11 years. I've been sober for 24 years and 2 months now, so I've been sober a lot longer than I drank, and I'm sorry I spent so much time on the drinking part, because the recovery part is the part that the most. That stuff, that all happened. If that hadn't happened, I wouldn't be here today. So that's okay. I didn't like it. I didn't like me. But, you know, things are different today. Things are different. At just about in the third year, I was still at Tiffany, still had this job. And I got mad at my boss for a number of reasons, and other things happened, and I'm not going to go into that because it's too detailed a story, but I decided to leave that job, and so I quit. And I'd asked for a transfer, and it didn't come through, and I just quit. And I had to apply for a new job. So I decided I wanted to make some money. I was tired. Tiffany's was great, but they didn't pay anything. And there were a lot of people that were working there that made a lot more money than I did, and I was really upset about it. So I applied for a job with Gordon Jewelry Corporation, which was one of the largest jewelry corporations in the world at the time. And I had to go downtown and take a lie detector test. Guess what? Because that's what you do when you're in my business. You take lie detector tests every time you change jobs. And so I went down and I took this lie detector test. There was this lovely young woman gave me this test, and I think she was gay. I flunked it miserably. And they weren't interested. So I was devastated because I had such a high opinion of myself. Now, you have to understand, I've now been sober for 3 years, right? I have a much different opinion of myself than I did 3 years before. This shouldn't happen. I got madder and madder and madder at everything and everybody around me. And it suddenly occurred to me that Jerry had told me that it would be time to do my fourth step. I would know, because I'd be mad at everybody. And I finally put two and two together, and I called him on the phone and made an appointment for a week later to do my fifth step. And I proceeded to do my fourth step the way he told me to do it, the way it's in the book. He told me that I could only bring 4 pieces of paper, though. He wasn't interested in a long history. So I did that. And I went home, sat with my dog in front of the fireplace. Al was out doing something, and I read the 6th and 7th step, and well, it was a few weeks later. It was in June. I got this phone call, and this young lady that I didn't know called and asked me if she said that I'd been highly recommended, and that they were looking for an assistant manager at Cartier. And so, if I was interested, they had a plane ticket for me to go to New York the next day and interview with the president of the company. And so I did that, and I came home, and I had to take another lie detector test. This time, now you understand, I flunked one, then I did my 4th and 5th step, then I took a lie detector test, and this time I went to Pasadena. And he was about 25 and 6'3 and 220 and a linebacker. And very straight. And I had to tell him about me. And I did, and I passed all the questions but one. asked me if I was married, and I said no, because legally I wasn't married, and I kept funking the test, and he kept thinking that I was hiding ex-wives or something, or ex-husbands or something. And the fact of the matter was that I was in this relationship. And, you know, lie detector tests go deeper than just this. And I considered myself married, so I couldn't pass that question. Well, things moved along. I got that job. And then 4 years later, when the French bought out the company and took it back over again and put it back into one company again. At the time I worked for them, they were three companies. A real bad day happened in 1983. I went to work one morning, and I was meeting with one of these guys from France, and he fired me because I was a dinosaur. They wanted, you know, I was trying to figure out how old I was. I wasn't even 40, but I was a dinosaur, and that was pretty devastating. That was in 1983. I'd been sober for 7 years. And, oh dear, that was a shock. But I survived it. I haven't talked much about my family. I had my youngest brother, the one who was 7 years older than I was, his name was Michael. Michael was an alcoholic. And one of the reasons I never associated myself with being an alcoholic was because I was so unlike him. He had gone off and done several tours of duty in Vietnam and had come home, and alcohol had broken up a marriage, and he had lived on the streets. He was not me. I, you know, was in suits and with fancy people and selling fancy expensive things, and he was, you know, on the street. And in 1985, my oldest brother, the hero in my family, the one who was a great success in life, retired. He was 50 years old, and actually, in 1984, he retired. He was 50, and he retired from, sold his company, and looked forward to a great retirement with lots of money and comforts and that sort of thing. And he had to have a test done for insurance because he was leaving he was getting rid of his company. He had to get a separate insurance policy for he and his family. And they found that he had cancer, and he was 50. And he was given a year to live. Now, at the time, my younger brother was living in a car under a bridge in Fort Worth. And he had tried to get sober many, many times. My mom and dad had, I remember once he celebrated a year of sobriety, and he had asked my parents for a Rolex watch. And my parents didn't buy Rolex watches. And they bought my brother a Rolex watch, and a few weeks later he hocked it and got drunk again. And I wouldn't like him. I just wouldn't like that. But Mikey, he found out that Bill, the hero, was sick. And his wife, his ex-wife, went to see him and in this car. And I don't know what she told him. She never told me, but he came out. He got out of the car, and he went back to her house, and she took him back, and he got sober. And he took civil service exam. Didn't have a regular job in years, and took a civil service exam and became a postman and went to work for the post office. And it was Oh, I guess it was about 10 months. He hadn't drank 9 or 10 months, and he finished his training period, and his first day of work was in June. I think it was the 21st of June in 1985, and he went to work that morning for the first time to do his route, and at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, his heart stopped in the middle of his route. He dropped dead. A hot day in Fort Worth. And a very merciful God saw that he was going the right direction. Everything was perfect in his life. And he left. I got a call that night that my brother had died. And of course, I was expecting my older brother to die anytime. And I was shocked that it was Mikey. And I had to go to Fort Worth and help arrange for his funeral. And then a couple of months later, Bill died shortly after Labor Day. And so I lost two brothers in 2 months. And I didn't ever think about drinking. Had a good foundation in this program. I'd stopped going to as many meetings. My sponsor moved away when I was 7 years sober. He moved off to California, and so I didn't get to talk to him or see him very much. And I stopped going to meetings as often as I had been going, and here I was at, you know, in my 10th year of sobriety, and you know, I'm losing two brothers and trying to, you know, to survive and make sense of all this. And when my 10th birthday came along, I just wasn't even there. And I felt terrible. I felt a lot like I felt when I first got sober. And oh, so I was 10 years sober, and I missed my birthday. And I woke up one morning, and I got on the phone, and I don't know if I don't remember how early in the morning it was, but needless to say, I called my sponsor. It was quite early in the morning. And he was living in Mendocino at the time, and I proceeded to tell him what I was going to do. Someone else earlier today asked me if I knew Norris L. And I said, yeah, he's part of my story. Because at 10 years sober, sponsor off in California and not going to very many meetings, I had to start over. Even though I didn't have to get drunk to start over, but I had to start over. You see, I wanted what I was told that, you know, when you pick a sponsor, you pick somebody who has something that you want. And Jerry was a good model. I wanted what he had. And Jerry told me in the beginning that if I wanted what he had, that I had to do the things that he did. But I thought I was an exception. I didn't have to do all that. Because that a lot of stuff he did made me horribly nervous. And I just didn't think I could do it. And people weren't going to like me anyway. And they liked him. Everybody liked him. He had this great big huge smile. He was always positive with everyone. I never heard him criticize anyone. I remember when I the first when early in my sobriety, along the first year or so, somebody in our little group got drunk, and I was just beside myself. I mean, how? You know, what? How? And Jerry told me, he said, Stan, you know, this program doesn't work if you haven't finished your drinking. He said, you know, you have to finish it. See, when you're done, then you can start getting it. He said he just wasn't ready. He got here too soon. You know, he hadn't finished drinking. And don't ever belittle anyone who's not finished with their drinking. Because you have to have your last drink. You have to be happy with your last drink. You have to be satisfied with your bottom in order to stay sober. So, anyway, I told him what I was going to do, and I went to a meeting that afternoon, and Norris L. was sitting across the room, and I think Norris had, I had 10 years, and I think Norris had 6, and there wasn't anybody there that were sober as long as I was in that meeting, and I had decided that, you know, the first person who really made sense to me, I was going to ask to be my temporary sponsor. While Jerry was off in California, I needed somebody at home who was going to be on top of me and help me do it. And so I humbled myself and asked Norris to sponsor me. And he agreed. And he said, okay. And we started going to a meeting once a week together. And I tried to start doing a few more meetings. And what I did was I went to the 515 meeting at Lambda, which at the time was over on Joanne Street. And it was a meeting that only had, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 people every day. And the same person happened to be leading the meeting, 3 meetings 1 week, and bless his heart. And so I made a commitment. I made a commitment. I wanted what he had. If I wanted what he had, if I wanted to be like that, if I wanted that sparkle in my eyes, if I wanted, I had to do the things I saw him do. So I adopted that group, the 515 group, Monday through Friday. Peggy, I'm sorry I don't stay for the meeting on Friday nights anymore, but I did that. And that's where I've been since. I rarely go to other meetings. I live in the 515 group, and the Sunday morning 9:30 group, which is really sort of my home group. I've been going to that one for many, many, many years, and I'm very grateful to be sober. It worked. Things smoothed out in my life. Somebody asked me to sponsor them. I'd never sponsored anybody. 10 years sober, 10 years of taking from this program and being sober and never having been, I would ask once but never called, but never having sponsored anyone. And all of a sudden, somebody asked me to sponsor them. Then somebody else. Then somebody else. And all of a sudden, I had these sponsorees that were, you know, calling me and depending upon me for, you know, for pearls of wisdom, which I was searching madly through the books for. You know, I've always felt like I could use people who were, you know, had less sobriety than I have. And I can't tell you how many times people have asked me questions and I said, I'll call you back, and I've called HB. And HB, I know you're in this room too. I miss him. I miss a lot of people. But I'm here, and I love this program, and I love my sobriety. It's a first for me today. You know, it's, if you've been counting, I met Al in 1974. He's sitting back there in the back today, 26 plus years later. My dad. My dad lives with us now, and my dad's back there. If you want to see what I'm going to look like in 30 years, he's there. It's exciting. I have a very good sober life today, thanks to this program. And you know, it's, my life has taken a turn in the last few years, and you know, there's stuff comes up, and I try to be, you know, positive all the time, and I try to encourage people, and I find that, you know, that sometimes I get depressed. And this has been one of those years when it's been really on me. In March, I was in a really down spot, and I didn't want anybody to know. You know, I have to hide that, you know, because, you know, all these people that go to those meetings, you know, they see all this sobriety and they think that, you know, it's we don't have this stuff going on. And the fact of the matter is that the road gets very narrow. And I was feeling really bad one day. I know exactly what day it was. It was March the 3rd. The reason I can tell you that, it's one of the reasons why I started. You know, I told you, I read this little bit from Day by Day because I get my direction. And you see, it told me that I was supposed to do this today. And I got up on March the 3rd, and I was completely overwhelmed. And I went out on the deck, and I sat down. And as I do every day, I picked up these meditation books, because that's what I was told Jerry did. He did this. I don't know if he did it or not. Don't tell me if he didn't. Because as you can well see, they're pretty worn out now, but, you know, these are treasures for me. But I picked up this book, and it hit me. So I'm going to leave you today with the reading, the meditation for the day of March 3rd out of the 24-hour day book. And this changed the direction for me this year. This little passage says, I will try to grow in this new life. I will think of spiritual things often, and unconsciously I will grow. The nearer I get to the new life, the more I will see my unfitness. My sense of failure is a sure sign that I am growing in this new life. It is only struggle that hurts. In sloth, physical, mental, spiritual, there is no sense of failure. But with struggle and effort, I am conscious not of strength, but of weakness, until I am really living this new life. And in this struggle, I can always rely on the power of God to help me. Thank you.